Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Sports, a podcast channel in the New Books Network. I am Dr. Jorge Hewitt of Texas Tech University, the host of the channel. Today, we're going to be talking to Joel Franks regarding his new book, Asian American Basketball, A Century of Sport, Community, and Culture, published by McFarland. Joel, thank you for joining us on the channel today.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Joel, before we get started discussing your book, please tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a native-born Californian, and more particularly, I've been living in the South Bay in the San Jose area all my life. I went to community college in this area, went to West Valley College. Then I went to San Jose State, where I got my BA and MA in history. Then I did something very daring. I headed down to Orange County to get a degree, get my PhD in the program in comparative culture down at UC Irvine.
Okay.
Which no longer exists. I mean, the department. And after that, I kind of struggled to get academic jobs. I worked in a variety of fields, including tech recruiting. And working with the developmentally disabled, but finally I got a lectureship at San Jose State, teaching primarily in Asian American Studies and American Studies department. But beyond that, I've got community colleges. Right now I'm teaching part time at De Anza College in Cupertino.
Okay, and I believe you are so you're retired from San Jose State. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay, good. Well, you know, I know that you have done a lot of work on Asian Americans and sports. How did you come to write this particular book?
Well, this particular book kind of grew out of my other work in the area of Asian Americans and sports. That is, several years ago, as we all know, Jeremy Lin hit the basketball world and the sports world in general as a big sensation. And what struck me then, well, beyond the fact that he was kind of a local guy, he came from an area close to where we live. He came from Palo Alto. Mm-hmm. And his brother, his younger brother, played against my son in high school.
Okay.
In basketball. Other than that, what struck me was the impression that a lot of people had that this was something startling, something new. Mm-hmm. Americans playing basketball. What a concept. And so I knew from my own studies that Asian Americans have been playing basketball for a long time. On their community teams, they played high school ball. Some of them played junior college and college ball. And we're not just talking about men, we're also talking about women. Mm-hmm. So this kind of led me to write this book, that is to talk about Asian American experiences beyond Jeremy Lin.
Okay. And you know, if I may, let me just ask you real quick that, you know, so in other words, what you're telling me is that people were shocked that an Asian American could be both very academically gifted, as Jeremy Lin is, given that he went to Harvard, and that they could also be athletic. Is that sort of the reaction that a lot of folks got from his story?
Right, not everybody, of course, especially
the
folks who are familiar with community basketball, Asian American, Chinese American, Japanese American basketball, but a lot of folks had that response. And I wanted to help correct that response, provide, even though I don't think Jeremy Lin himself, and I don't know really too much about his youth, I don't think he was that much of a product of Asian American community basketball or Chinese American community basketball. Mm-hmm. Asian American basketball in general is rooted in the community.
Right. And we're gonna get to that. So I think that's a good point for us to begin to focus on the question specifically on the from the book. And again, just at the very start of the book, you mentioned that newspapers of the 1920s and 1930s featured anti-Asian politics and racial nativism. Can you give us an example or two about how this played out concerning Asian American athletes? And I guess it does tie in with this question that we were just discussing about Jeremy Lin.
Right. Well, I think there was an attempt to exoticize Asian American athletes. To the extent that they appeared in mainstream newspapers and mainstream teams as either something special or something or as something that needed to be marginalized. So one way that was often done was really focusing on the issue of height and to an excessive extent. That is, of course, Asian Americans do tend to be smaller than other groups of people. But even when Asian American athletes were relatively normal size, for example, there was an excellent Cal basketball player by the name of Ted Ohashi, who played in the early 1930s for Cal. And he was about 6 feet tall, which was not an unusually small size for a guard back in those days, or even now. You would see references to Ted Ohashi as tiny, as little, or small, and whether consciously or not, it seemed to project the sense that these people are strange. They're weird. They are not normal.
And they shouldn't be playing an all-American game like basketball.
Or if they do, it's just damn weird. I mean, it's just something that is just abnormal. Something that should be expected.
And you realize, of course, that you know Ignacio Garcia over at BYU did a few book a few years ago called "When Mexicans Could Play Ball," and a lot of the same arguments. Particularly here in Texas, are being made about Mexican American basketball players, primarily in the San Antonio area.
Right.
Yeah. So these folks are considered quote exotic, and they shouldn't really be on the basketball court, or if they are, there's something just highly unusual about them.
Right. And I think and beyond that, something that does kind of link to Latino athletes is the exaggeration in terms of how the press deal with language. That is, I've done a lot of work on a group of largely Asian American baseball players from Hawaii who barnstormed the U.S. Now, a lot of these guys were U.S. because they were born in Hawaii. They were U.S. citizens. Many of them went to school, the high school and beyond. They were perfectly capable of speaking. You know, I'm air quoting now, and this doesn't help you at all.
Sure.
Mainstream English, but they're often, you know, they're often quoted in the press as speaking a broken English.
Right. Yeah. And that certainly is not unique to the Asian American. Obviously Roberto Clemente and some of these other great major league ball players of the late 1950s and 1960s, early 1960s had to suffer through the same, situation.
Right.
Okay. Now, in chapter one, you discuss the role of basketball in Asian American communities up until the end of World War II. How did the game start in those communities? What were some of the key areas of concentration in regards to geographic areas of concentration for these basketball teams? And can you also just give us a sense of some of the most important teams and athletes in places such as San Francisco, Portland, and Boston?
Okay. I'll try to help me here as I go through this. In terms of why basketball started in Asian American communities, I think Asian Americans in Hawaii and the West Coast, and even on the East Coast, and Midwest, tended to be urban. I mean, that's a tendency, but tended to be urban. And basketball seems to be the perfect urban sport. It doesn't.
Right.
You don't need that much room to do it, and you can play it outside. You can play it inside. You don't need a lot of equipment or expensive uniforms. And Asian American communities up through 1945 were generally working class, and generally the boys and girls who played the sport as kids and as they grew up towards young adulthood, they didn't have a lot of money. So basketball proved to be kind of a good way to demonstrate their athletic skills, have a little fun, and represent at the same time.
Right.
At the same time, there were community efforts to encourage this. Community basketball by way of community elders, one of youth sports like basketball as a way to generate bonds across generations. The Buddhist church might want to use basketball as a way to kind of bring in or maintain support from from second generation people who might be tempted to play, join the YMCA or join other churches.
Mm-hmm.
So there was various, you know, external and internal forces encouraging people to engage in.
And this pattern was similar across all of these communities, whether they were on the West Coast or on the East Coast.
Well, I think so. Although my primary research has been more on the West Coast and Hawaii than on the East Coast. But where you generally have found Asian Americans, at least up through 1945. But I think so. To a wide extent, I tend to see the same situation developing in New York and Philadelphia, as Seattle, L.A., San Francisco, San Jose, Honolulu.
Okay. What was the significance of the sport to the Japanese Americans who were interned in the some of the various reconcentration camps during World War II?
I think it's kind of interesting, and one thing which, you know, I tried to provide some perspective on is that, you know, generally speaking, when people think about Japanese American athletic endeavors in the camps, they generally focus on baseball, for understandably. But basketball was a sport which kind of linked football to baseball. It was something which in the camps, once again, could be played relatively easily, without a lot of equipment, without a lot of space. Although in places like some camps were in god awful places, it could be god awful cold during the winter.
Right.
And so, Heart Mountain Camp in Wyoming, basketball players and supporters at that camp were kind of disturbed at the fact that they had to play outside, you know, in November, December, and February. So they wanted to be able to play basketball indoors. And the one thing about basketball is, for Japanese Americans, basketball has been seen as a community endeavor which crossed gender lines.
Okay.
And so for girls and young women, basketball was their sport in the camp. Baseball might have been the sport for the men, but basketball was a sport for the young women.
Okay. In chapter two, you look at Chinese and Japanese American basketball in the years between 1945 and 1965. What is the significance of those two decades? And again, what were some of the important teams or some of the important players that you could mention for us from that chapter?
Well, in terms of the post-war years, well, the war itself kind of generated, for a wide variety of reasons, this sense of racial liberalism that we have fought against tyrannical powers, totalitarian powers that have tried to advance a racist ideology. And so if we're going to proclaim ourselves, if America's going to proclaim itself as the land of the free, the home of the brave, then maybe we should do something about adding at least some facets of institutionalized racism.
Okay.
We do start to see more immigration reform, and we start to see policies which open up greater opportunities for second and third generation Asian Americans, like under the GI Bill.
Mm-hmm.
We see Asian Americans start to spread out from their communities to the suburbs. And so more and more sports become a way for people to link to one another, even though one person might be playing or might be living in San Jose, and his or her parents might be in San Francisco, Chinatown. Sports was a way to link Chinese Americans, Japanese Americans, Filipino Americans across three geographical distances.
Now, were some of these community teams were some of these community teams playing against white teams?
Oh, yeah.
Or African American teams?
Well, less African American teams, but you do find some examples of that, But I do want to also modify my earlier statement. It isn't to say that there was no longer San Francisco Chinatown. San Francisco Chinatown dramatically transformed itself because of suburbanization, but San Francisco Chinatown remained a hub, for example, for Chinese American basketball for at least a decade after World War II. And two of the best Asian American basketball, community basketball teams came out of San Francisco Chinatown, and both of them sponsored by the St. Mary's Church. So the male team was called the San Francisco Chinese Saints, and the female team was called, surprisingly enough, the Lady Saints.
Okay.
They were led by siblings. The Wong brothers. Willie Wong was a sensational basketball player, 5'3" with a great outside shot. He was called by the press Woo Woo Wong, played a little bit for USF. And his sister, Helen Wong, was a sensational basketball player and also a star tennis player in the 1950s. And so I do want to emphasize that while people are kind of spreading out to the suburbs, urban communities still provide a hub for a lot of the basketball play taking place.
Okay, okay. You mentioned earlier the Filipino community. How does the game begin in the Filipino community? And again, what are some of the key locations for that community's endeavors in basketball?
Well, in terms of origins, I'm going to do a little bit of speculation here, but when the U.S. Conquered the Philippines, the U.S. used sports as one of the ways to kind of pacify the so-called native of football and basketball. And so I think there was, before Filipinos came to the U.S., a lot of them were familiar with American sports or sports that Americans claimed some possession over, like baseball, volleyball, and basketball. So probably a lot of these young men were familiar with basketball as they came here. Once again, they faced, as other Asian American communities, they faced a lot of housing discrimination, job discrimination. So if they were going to form basketball teams, they would have to form them on their own. And probably one of the most famous Filipino-American community team was a team called the San Francisco Mangos, which played out of San Francisco beginning in the late 40s for at least another decade. And it was started by a group of young men on their own without much support from community elders. But once they started to beat teams, then community elders started to help finance the team. Now, up and down the West Coast, basketball was a big activity for Filipino young people. They had tournaments up and down the West Coast, from Seattle, down to Los Angeles. And a lot of Filipino young men and women who are a part of these tournaments have vivid memories of those experiences of traveling from their homes to places like San Jose or Seattle to play other teams. Some of the best memories of their youth revolved around these community basketball endeavors.
And you know what? You sort of, that answer sort of moves us over to chapters 3 and 4, because what you talk about in those chapters is how Asian Americans used basketball as a cultural, to create cultural border crossings. Specifically, you mentioned how cross-racial ethnic basketball played out in places such as Hawaii. Why don't you discuss that for a little bit?
Well, Hawaii is kind of an interesting place, and it's often presented as kind of this racial paradise, and which is very exaggerated. But race does work differently in Hawaii. From my perspective, there's a tremendous collaboration. Or I should say tremendous in a positive sense, but powerful collaboration between race, ethnicity, and class. And so we see in Hawaii, more so than in the mainland, the possibility of, in the early 1900s, that is during the first half of the 1900s, you might more likely see a Chinese American living next door to a Portuguese American or a Filipino American. That is, residence and schooling revolved around class to a significant extent.
Okay.
And so you might see more likely, you might see, on the one hand, ethnic-based teams and leagues, Japanese American League, Chinese American League, Filipino American League. But at the same time, you might see more multiracial teams or multi-ethnic teams. Clustered around job, neighborhood, that sort of thing. Much more than you might see on the mainland at that same time.
Okay. Give us a sense of, and I know you've mentioned the fact that Asian American women played basketball, but give us some specifics. You know, again, what were some, you know, couple of key teams or key players from that 1945 to 1965 era?
Well, as I said before, the San Francisco Chinese Saints are probably the best known female Asian American team, at least on the U.S. mainland. And they're led by Helen Wong, and they played white teams. I believe they played at least one black team. They won way more often than they lost, although they did tend to be a little bit on the small side. So if they ran into teams that were pretty big, then they might lose. But everybody often had tremendous things to say about Helen Wong. Mm-hmm. I probably mentioned in the book the fact that she went to a school led by Hank Luthetti, you know, who was the Michael Jordan of the mid-20th century. And okay. People were astonished at her shooting ability. Like Hank Luthetti himself said that she was the only person in the whole camp, male or female, who was able to command the one-handed set shot that he helped pioneer. And so that's one example. Another example is something that does kind of precede the 1945. I want to kind of get back to it because I didn't talk about these people much in the book. And I'm working on a history of sports in California. I want to kind of rectify it.
Okay.
So, and this is a group of Japanese American women from Stockton called the Busy Bees. And they dominated Japanese American female basketball from 1928 to 1940, no, from 1928 to 1940. They won about 240 games straight, and they barnstormed the Southwest, playing various Japanese American teams. They had no particular star like Helen Wong, but they were a machine, and they kind of represented the pride of Japanese Americans in the Central Valley, very, very adequately.
Now that you mentioned that term pride and represented, you know, and we'll talk again some more about this towards the end when we once again we bring up Jeremy Lin and also the head coach of the Miami Heat, Eric Spoelstra. What do you think, or what would your argument be as far as what these teams, these successful teams, these successful athletes represent to the broader community, to the white community? How is their success a challenge to white hegemony?
Well, you know, I think the answer is somewhat ambivalent because on the one hand, it does offer a challenge. I mean, these success stories do offer a challenge to white hegemony. But at the same time, the struggle has to be continually fought. And it kind of jump ahead to Jeremy Lin. I mean, that is Asian Americans as well as other marginalized people that have to, and not just in sports, they have to keep on proving themselves over and over again. And so that is, to go back to that baseball team I talked about from Hawaii, these guys won 60, 70, 80% of their games, okay, from the years 1912 to 1916, against college teams, semi-pro teams, Negro League teams, and some minor league teams. And after it was all done, people said, wow, what a great team. And it's forgotten. That is, to a certain extent, the links are established, positive press is generated, but it's been forgotten.
Yeah.
White hegemony is a powerful thing, and it can be chipped away at, but there's always it is pretty effective at, you know, plastering over those chips.
Mm-hmm. Now, so far we've talked about community teams and some high school teams. In Chapter 5, you focus on Asian Americans at the collegiate and even at the professional level. Again, who were some of the most important players of these years up to about the mid-1960s?
Okay, well, there weren't, admittedly, a lot of success in terms of Asian Americans penetrating four-year schools and pro schools. But at the same time, we do find on the college level, athletes like Tedohashi, as I said before, who was considered to be a very good defender and ball handler for Cal. He was considered to be one of the best players on the Pacific Coast in the early 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
And during World War II, we see some Asian Americans playing for big time schools like University of Washington and University of Oregon and Gonzaga.
Wasn't there a basketball a Japanese American who helped lead the University of Utah to a national title, I believe?
Wadmasaka.
Okay.
And played for University of Utah and led the University or helped lead University of Utah. I shouldn't make him a one-man team because he wasn't. There are several good players on that team. But certainly helped lead University of Utah to an NCAA championship and an NIT championship at a time when the NIT, because it was stage of New York City, was considered to be the equal of the NCAA.
Right, right.
And his performance at Madison Square Garden was so extensive and so impressive during the NIT that it helped the guy who ran the New York Knickerbockers at that time, Ned Irish, ran Madison Square Garden and the New York Knickerbockers, assigned Wadmasaka to a contract to the New York Knickerbockers.
Really?
And
okay.
He played for New York Knickerbockers we call them New York Knicks now, for a few games. He did get cut, apparently because he wasn't tall enough. Although, once again, there are other 5'8" to 5'9" guards in playing elite professional basketball at that time.
Okay.
I think I'm interestingly enough, Abe Saperstein, who ran the Harlem Globetrotters at that time, offered Wadmasaka a contract to travel with the Globetrotters. And Wadmasaka said, I guess I haven't had enough with professional basketball. I want to get an engineering degree. So he said, the heck with that.
Okay. Now, Chapter 6 now moves us to the years beyond 1965. And I guess really the key thing that's happening here is that Asian Americans are becoming more integrated into the broader American society. How does that impact community basketball?
Well, I think I was trying to get back to it earlier. I think, once again, it affects it because now you have to deal with the fact that you've got a lot of people that have moved out of concentrated ethnic enclaves in San Francisco and L.A. So more and more community basketball is about actually linking people across maybe relatively small geographical barriers, but still significant, and also class barriers, because now we start to see people moving in the suburbs. They're thanks to the GI Bill and economic growth, they're able to put together middle class lifestyles. And so community basketball becomes a way, once again, like in my hometown of my home area of Santa Clara County, the San Jose Japantown really does. There no longer is a lot of people living in San Jose, Japantown. Japanese Americans are now living in San Jose, but you can find them in Cupertino and Palo Alto and Mountain View. But Japanese American leagues and Japanese American community leagues and teams are able to kind of bring together people from different geographic areas in the South Bay and across essentially generational lines and class lines. And so it becomes a way for people who might live miles away from Japantown to kind of link up to their past. So community basketball becomes a way, once again, for people to develop a sense of cultural citizenship, a sense of belonging to an ethnic group, but also wanting to make links to people beyond that ethnic group.
Okay. Again, in this era, who are some of the key female players in that post 65 era?
Well, thanks to Title IX, we start to see college basketball become a major venue for a significant mm-hmm. number of Asian American basketball players. In recent years, for example, a number of Japanese American basketball players have played big time college basketball. Relatively close by, Lindy Yamasaki from the Pacific Northwest was a 6'2" forward for Stanford when Stanford always has elite basketball teams. Mm-hmm. Down in Los Angeles, Let's see. God, I kind of blanked out on these win. Oh, Khalid Matsahar was a successful coach for UC Irvine during the 1990s. And USC and UCLA have also suited up very fine Japanese-American point guards. In fact, a number of Division I, Division II, Division III teams have Asian-American female basketball players.
Okay. Let's try to bring this, I think, to the present now. And we've talked about Jeremy Lin, and, you know, I mentioned Eric Spoelstra. What would you argue is the significance of a player like Lin and a coach like Spoelstra?
Well, I think hopefully they have built significant links to experiences beyond that of Asian Americans. They provided a culture bridge. People now are more aware of the fact that a person of Jeremy Lin's ethnic background or Eric Spoelstra's ethnic background can play well or coach well. And by the way, Eric Spoelstra was an excellent basketball coach. Basketball player for Portland. He wasn't of NBA caliber, but he was a very good basketball player. And by the way, Eric Spoelstra does possess Filipino ancestry.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. And so hopefully it does build cultural bridges. Hopefully it inspires a lot of young people of Asian ancestry to want to play more basketball, to want to at least succeed as much as they possibly can, given the fact that there are other ways to be successful in basketball than being in the NBA. I think that's one of my inspirations is to recognize that there are multiple ways in which sports are good,
right,
being played by elite athletes.
Right.
But to the extent that they have been able to and continue to generate interest in sport as something that's fun, enjoyable, something that you can master, and something that isn't beyond your ability, that Asian Americans can be good basketball players, they can be good basketball coaches, and I think they've done a world of good. Despite the fact, at least in Jeremy Lin's case, there's been a lot of frustration.
And who is Jeremy Lin playing for now? I really do not remember.
A Chinese professional team.
Okay.
But I think he did quit that team, and he's going to try to get back into the NBA.
Okay. And let's hope, being from Miami, I am certainly hopeful that Eric Spoelstra will be able to guide the Heat to at least one more win against the Lakers.
That would be nice. I mean, you know, unlike a lot of people up in the Bay Area, I don't hate anything about, I don't hate anything produced by Los Angeles. I have to admit that back in the 80s, 60s, and 70s, I kind of liked the Lakers. I like Magic and Kareem, and even before that, Jerry West and Elgin Baylor. I don't have any particular hatred for the Lakers, but I agree. I kind of like upsets, and I think it'd be great. And I think I enjoy watching the Miami Heat. Although if Dragic is still hurt, then I don't know.
Yes, sir. You know, I think really towards the end of the book, and this is one of the reasons why I enjoy your work as much as I do, because I think in many ways it mirrors some of the research that I do. At the end of the book, you argue that one of the goals in your work was to develop, quote, a more democratic perspective on sports history. A, what do you mean by that? And B, how does this book help to accomplish that goal?
Well, what I mean by that, and the part of it is there's something that, I mean, more and more, this is a paper tiger. I mean, I think my concerns about developing a more democratic perspective on sports history is more and more being alleviated, partly by you and, you know, other scholars. But when I started to do sports history, and mostly, it was East Coast oriented,
mm-hmm,
for understandable reasons, and elite sport oriented. That is oriented towards, you know, New York, Boston, Philadelphia,
right,
the elite teams, the elite athletes who are disproportionately white. And to the extent that people might transcend whiteness, then it was about African Americans living on the East Coast. And so a whole bunch of sporting experiences beyond the East Coast were being not totally, but largely ignored.
Yeah.
And so my feeling was if we're going to provide a more democratic perspective on sports history, we have to expand. We had to expand beyond the East Coast to the West, to Hawaii, to Samoa. We had to expand our look, our perspective on sports history to American Indians, Mexican Americans, Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders, and look more at the experiences not only of race and ethnicity and gender, but also the experiences of class. I mean, right. That it was, you know, I mean, one of the things which generate community sports to a significant extent is the fact that a lot of the kids involved were working class kids or poor kids. And they couldn't play in school sports, partly because their parents didn't want them to go to school beyond a certain point because they had to earn money to help the family out. And if right. they did go to school, their parents wanted them to concentrate on either doing their homework after they got home from school or working around the house or working in the family business or looking after the siblings. So the right. time they could play often was at night when they didn't have to work or they finished their studies or on a Sunday. And so we have to also look at the issue of class and how that intersects race and ethnicity.
Right, right. Well, I think that's a great response, and I hope that this type of work continues to encourage scholars to look at even more varied aspects of the American sporting scene, especially among minorities. And again, you know, move beyond that black-white dichotomy that has been so prevalent in American sports history for so long.
I mean, it was understandably generated. I mean,
sure.
There's nothing intrinsically wrong about studying East Coast history or the experiences of racial minority groups on the East Coast. It just have to expand it.
Right, right. Joel, is there anything that we have not covered that you would want to discuss?
Well, I'm sure about 2 or 3 days from now I'll think of something, but not right now.
Okay. Well, Joel, believe it or not, we've been talking for about 45 minutes. We've taken up quite a bit of your time. I want to thank you for visiting with us. This is a great, great book. Again, let me mention the title. It's Asian American Basketball, A Century of Sport, Community, and Culture, published by McFarland. Thank you so much for spending time with me today.
Okay, well, thank you for having me.